Hello and welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. I'm John Burns and this is my podcast for folk who love the outdoors. There was some great news up here in the Highlands recently, and that was that beaver were released into the Spey Valley for return, I guess, for the first time in maybe something like 300 years. It wasn't without controversy, but I think that'll make a huge difference to particularly the Cairngorms and the Monolier and those all that area, all that catchment zone. Over the years, beaver will change the landscape, and I think that's a great thing that it returned. So my guest today is one of the trustees of Scotland, the Big Picture, Scotland's rewilding charity. And I've asked him along today to do a very difficult task, really, to kind of sum up where he thinks we are with rewilding. Alan's a lifelong environmentalist, from fighting for a moratorium on whale hunting in the early 80s to today's urgent challenges to reverse biodiversity decline and combat climate change. He's a teacher, and as I've said, he's also a trustee of Scotland, the Big Picture. And in this role, he works to ensure that young people have their voice heard when discussing the future of the natural environment in Scotland. Hello, Alan.
Hi, John. Thanks for inviting me along today.
That's my pleasure to have you. Sorry, that's a rather a big task I've asked you to perform today. But tell us, first of all, how did you get involved in rewilding and sort of fighting the decline of nature that's been going on for so long?
Well, as I say, yeah, I mean, I've been, I guess, environmentalist since I can remember as a youngish lad, from fighting for, as you've said already, for stopping commercial whale hunting. That hasn't been completely successful. It still goes on. We've still got Japan and Norway, until kind of today when I started to learn a little bit more about rewilding and realised that was kind of the next kind of development in conservation, looking at conservation a bit more holistically. And I started to put together a community of rewilding sites and information online, and that's how eventually some people from Scotland Big Picture got in touch with me and asked if I wanted to go along and work with them. And obviously being a teacher, they asked me to look at specifically how we can ensure that young people's voices are integrated into this debate. You know, rewilding will be an intergenerational project, 100 years, 500 years, however long. It's important that those people have their voices front and foremost.
Can I ask you, I mentioned the reintroduction of the beaver. What impact do you think that will make, sort of, I suppose, positively on the environment, but also, you know, as I said, it is quite controversial in certain areas. Where do you see that particular aspect going?
Yeah, I mean, it's been in the news recently. We've had the recent reintroductions into Cairngorms National Park, and there have been some landowners and managers who have been concerned about that. There's no doubt the beavers, you know, have a massive impact on the landscape, and that can impact land use. So we have to take that into consideration. I don't think the negative impact that they describe is going to be as substantial as they believe. I think beavers can live harmoniously within the Scottish environment. I think ecologically, the benefits far outweigh the challenges. I think the challenges can be mitigated against. I think not only environmentally, the benefits to biodiversity that beavers bring, I think it also brings a layer of hope to Scotland. And I know that it's brought various tourism businesses in place. So, yeah, there's a lot of, it's multifaceted.
Yeah, that's an interesting, you talk about businesses as sort of commercial interests. I mean, I read concerns for Loch Abba recently. They're talking about the fact that the population is declining. I think I could be wrong. I think it's about 4% in a decade. And also we've got an aging population. And it seems to me that sometimes people try to set a there seem to be two voices. Voices arguing for, if you like, industrialization, for building spaceports up in Sutherland. And it also feels to me as if there's an artificial divide, really, between those voices and people like yourself who are arguing for rewilding. Do you think that is a real dilemma, or is it, I imagine that?
I mean, certainly, you know, being involved in the rewilding sphere, I see new job opportunities come up every day in rewilding or ecological restoration in Scotland, from peatland restoration to ecologists. And that's not only, it's also for young people who are already working on the land in Scotland. It can offer opportunities to them. Some people like to portray it as the death of, I don't know, gamekeeping or whatever. And it truly doesn't have to be. Gamekeepers and young gamekeepers will have a really important part to play in this work going forward.
Yeah, I think it's a question sort of balance. I mean, certainly on Mull, for example, the sea eagles there have brought a lot of employment, a lot of money into the area, and that's maybe a way things could go. I was only remembering, I spoke to, is it Steve Hetherington?
And yeah.
On here, it must be, God, it could be almost 10 years ago, and I don't, it's a long time ago anyway, it feels a long time ago. And we were talking about his campaigning for the reintroduction of the lynx. And at the time, I think I said to him, I didn't think I'd live to see it. I'm about 70, so I don't know. Just to give you an idea, you know. And so I don't know. Where do you think the reintroduction of the lynx is? Where are we with that?
Well, John, I'm hopeful for you. I am hopeful. I think that's the only
thank you.
You know, yes, Dave Hetherington works in Cairngorms National Park as an ecologist, and obviously is an expert in lynx, and wrote the wonderful book, The Lynx and Us.
Yeah.
Currently, Scotland Big Picture, the charity I work with, Trees for Life and Lifescape. It's a three-way partnership to further the possibility of lynx being reintroduced to Scotland. We've done a lot of work around the country, in town halls and village huts and things with land managers and farmers, talking to them about their concerns. We understand their concerns, and some of them will be legitimate and must be addressed. We obviously need to work with government and Nature Scot to, you know, eventually we hope at some point be able to put an application into Nature Scot for a reintroduction. Again, like beavers and seagulls, there will be challenges, there's no doubt about it, but again, the benefits both environmentally, economically for Scotland, I think vastly outweigh the few challenges that there are. And I think some of the challenges that people perceive perhaps aren't really challenges at all. We did a webinar recently with sheep farmers and a lynx ecologist. And when we actually kind of delve in a bit deeper, I think we can put some of their concerns, make them less concerning to them, because I don't think lynx are going to have an impact on sheep. I think there's a misconception. Lynx are woodland ambush predators of small deer mainly. So I'm hopeful, John, that, you know, let's keep our fingers crossed, and with a fair wind, I'd really hope to see lynx return to Scotland.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be a great thing. A symbolic thing, really. I mean, let's not talk about the wolf. That seems to be a long, long way. But lynx certainly. I think the impact that lynx would make would be largely positive. I mean, well, what do you see as the positive things that the reintroduction of lynx could bring to us?
Well, environmentally, there's a few different things. Obviously, all the evidence from around the world shows that having apex predators within the ecosystem, within the food web, makes the whole ecosystem healthier and more robust. So I don't think there's many people who could argue against that. Lynx would create a landscape of fear for deer in Scotland. We have 1 million deer. Well, last time we counted, and that was some time ago, we have at least 1 million deer in Scotland, and lynx would create a landscape of fear where lynx would kill a few deer, but not that many. It wouldn't have a great impact on numbers, but what it would do is make the deer more fearful and make them move on more quickly in one particular area so they didn't overgraze that area. Lynx also create carrion, so their carcasses are food for a multitude of animals. There's nutrient recycling. There is evidence, some evidence from Europe, that obviously having an apex predator might reduce red fox numbers in certain areas. Red fox don't appear to like to be in the same range. That can have a positive impact on things like capercaillie and other things, wildcat as well. I mean, lynx live alongside capercaillie, wildcat, and all of these things in the rest of Europe. So I don't really see, although, you know, Scotland is a different landscape, I don't really see any reason why that shouldn't be the case here. And then the other aspect is economic. If you look at places like Poland and Germany, there's a real lynx and the Iberian lynx in Spain and Portugal. There's a real economy built around it, from hotels, tourism. Although lynx are elusive, there are lots and thousands of people who will pay to visit these areas just at the very thought of the presence of lynx being in the woodland that they're walking in.
Right, because we're basically, you'd be very lucky to see lynx once they're released, wouldn't you? I mean, they would sort of vanish into the woodland very much, you know?
Yeah.
Where do you think we are in terms of reforestation? I mean, you see places like Glenfeshie, which is very much sort of being repopulated by native woodlands, and that I believe is largely simply by reducing deer numbers. Where do you think we are with that in terms of creating the kind of forestry that we need, really?
I think the estimates are that we have less than 4% native woodland in Scotland. So a lot of that woodland is in poor condition because of overgrazing. It's not really young saplings growing through to replace. There's obviously wonderful examples in Glenfeshie and Mar Lodge. There's been a certain amount of planting in these places, but a lot of it has been down to reducing deer numbers to one or two per square kilometre.
Right.
It's interesting at Mar Lodge, they recognise that when they did reduce their deer population, the deer that were left became healthier, stronger, and more fertile, interestingly. Because deer are meant to be a woodland animal, so these deer that live in the woodlands are seem to be healthier than the deer that live out on the hill all the time.
Yeah, because I think the deer that we have, a huge population of deer that we have, they're sort of stunted deer that we have, aren't they? They would naturally be a lot bigger than they are.
Well, the story goes at some point, I can't remember the full story, but somebody was over in Germany and saw these hefty beasts and thought these must be a kind of subspecies and brought these red deer over to Scotland. But over a couple of generations, they immediately went down to the kind of more weedy red deer that we have here because they just were in a different environment.
So it's quite, and one of the interesting things that I think that you raised in your introduction really was the voices of young people. And I from my perception, I've been on the hills far too long, really. But when I began hill walking and climbing, God folk in Abothy, there would be very, very little discussion about what was happening in the natural environment in the hills. I sense a big change in that. And I wonder what your perspective is on the views of young people who, after all, really hold the key to what happens, as you said, in future generations. Do you think that the attitude of young people has changed or is changing? Or what are your feelings about that?
I think it has. I think there's still a long way to go. I think I've got a 16-year-old, and he tells me what the kind of conversations he's having with people at school. And there are still a lot of young people who either aren't aware enough of what's happening, or and some won't be interested at all. But no, on the whole, I think it is changing. Certainly, we've got an amazing group of young people either working for Scotland Big Picture, or volunteering, or coming along to our conferences. So I'm really hopeful. I really am. Scotland Big Picture are just about to launch we do lots of different things. One of the things is we do filmmaking, and we've got a new film coming out called Why Not Scotland, launching on Friday. And it follows a young girl who travels around Europe, Italy, Germany, Poland, Norway, looking at some of the the improvements in the environment in those countries and coming back to Scotland and saying, there doesn't, is there a reason why we're not doing it here? What are the barriers and how can we move forward? So, no, I'm really hopeful. I think things have been changing. And certainly, I think, I mean, I'm in, you know, early 50s, but certainly if you look at some of the young TikTok accounts of people out in the hills and talking about the environment, I've always got to be hopeful. That's the only way to be.
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons to be hopeful. I mean, I think I've certainly seen quite a major change, which has been accelerating, I would say, over the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, when I first came to Scotland, it felt like the very large, very traditional sporting estates were essentially these great monoliths that were here to stay and weren't going anywhere. But the things are changing in that I think there's a kind of recognition, even amongst the sort of sporting establishment, that a move away from these vast herds of deer and these devastated landscapes is both in their benefit and to ours. It feels as though it's a bit of the glaciers melting, you know. I don't know if you feel that's the case or not.
Yeah, I think so. I think there still are vast swathes of Scotland. Yeah. There's the sporting estates that can do a lot more, but there are, you know, people like Dee Ward at Rossall Estate. You know, he's a really forward-thinking owner. I mean, he still has driven grouse shooting, which personally I can't really come to terms with at all. You know, I wouldn't call myself an anti-hunter, because I think if you're going to go out, you know, and shoot something and take it and eat it, then, you know, I could accept that. So I can kind of accept walked-up grouse shooting, but I can't management practices of driven grouse shooting. But if you look at someone like him, the environmental stewardship that he's doing aside from the grouse moor is outstanding, and I think there'll be lots of new land managers and gamekeepers who come through. And although I think stocking needs to change as well, I think we shouldn't just have them out on the open hill as woodland returns. I hope that, you know, hunting deer within woodland becomes more attractive, more of a challenge rather than on the barren hills. I think there are real improvements within but a long way to go still.
I think I'm right in thinking that the registration for grouse moors has been introduced by the Scottish government. But I think that was against quite a lot of opposition, I think.
The final reading of that bill, I believe, is this week.
I didn't realise that. Okay.
So there's a one final chance for people to put in amendments. So I think we're looking at that very carefully to see if there's any last minute amendments that maybe weaken the bill. But I'm hoping that will be good for everyone, that you know, the states and the environment. So.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was quite surprised at one point. Actually, as far as I'm aware, no one really knows with complete accuracy just how much land is given over to driven grouse shooting. Is that right?
I mean, I think I've had various debates about this. It depends how you measure it. Measurements, you know, they'll use satellite instruments and look at the muir burn and look at when was the last muir burn, and therefore, and then how do you measure how far out from that muir burn you would consider sporting a state? I mean, I would argue that in some sporting estates, the number of killing mechanisms, traps and snares go far out with where the muir burn area is. So, you know, right down to the public road. And so, it depends how you measure it. But we're safe to say that sporting interests are a vast amount of Scottish uplands.
Yeah, still. I mean, huge areas. And there are huge areas where basically not a lot happens, really. I remember I was on a train recently coming up from Edinburgh, and we were passing over to Drogheda, and a woman commented to me, "Isn't this magnificent?" And talking about and I realized, actually, I think it depends what you see when you look out of that train window, because what I see is a devastated landscape that's been absolutely scoured of the life that should be there. And maybe some other people see scenic hills, I don't know. But are you, in terms of where do you see, where would you like to see us in about 10 years' time? That's a big question, isn't it? Sorry, I spring these on you.
Good question. I mean, I guess There are going to be more and more estates who manage their land in a more environmentally friendly way, and that's going to continue. I think Scotland Big Picture have been working with smaller land holdings, community woodlands,
yeah.
small farms, small estates to help. We kind of think of ourselves as facilitators to help them create a kind of patchwork of stepping stones across Scotland. So we have the larger estates, we have the smaller land holdings. So, you know, that, again, I think that's positive. I think it needs to accelerate because climate change and biodiversity loss is so pressing.
Yes.
I don't feel that urgency within government and the public is great enough at the minute. I think that is something that needs to change.
Think my feeling is that in some ways what we really kind of need is a kind of vision of Scotland as to where it, what, you know, what it could be like. I think that's a really important question, really, because you've got different forces pulling in different directions. You've got vast areas of land in the ownership of a very small number of folk, really. And it always strikes me as really a contradiction that our most valuable possession, which is the land itself, is actually something that we don't really control that much. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, really important point. I mean, some would argue that because of the historical strange concentration of land ownership in Scotland, if a landowner decides to rewild, for sake of argument, you can get a lot of rewilding done very quickly. But you could also sort of say, how fair is that? What is the social justice there? How are they taking in community voices? And one thing that has happened recently, which I've been really happy about, the Scottish Rewilding Alliance have come up with an agreement with Community Land Scotland to have a joint call for land reform and rewilding movements to work together for community, climate, and the nation. So I think that's really, that's I think that's going to be key for the next decade, that we look at land reform and social justice and rewilding all as one, not as separate issues.
I mean, in a way that is revolutionary, but in a way that's kind of what we need. I mean, it always strikes me that you got me onto another high horse, really. but it's so strange that the ownership of Scotland is really a result of an accident, really, and we're living with the results of I suppose feudal decision making processes hundreds of years later right now. That strikes me as a very odd thing.
I'm sure you've read it and you've maybe mentioned it in previous podcasts, but everybody should read The Poor Had No Lawyers from Andy Whiteman. He explains very clearly how we got to where we are. In fact, Andy Whiteman speaks on the new new film, Why Not Scotland. He kind of introduces he sets the scene of why Scotland is the way it is. And then hopefully we address where Scotland could be in a decade, in 100 years.
Right. Well, I think that's perhaps where we might end, drawing to a close anyway. But tell us about Why Not Scotland. Where can people go to see that film then? That sounds a very important film.
Well, at the minute, we're just having the kind of launch, the first screening on Friday at the National Museum of Scotland. I think it's sold out. I'm sorry, it's going on a little bit of a tour around Scotland. So if you go to Scotland Big Pictures website, there'll be a link there.
Right.
And I think we're offering kind of community screenings, and then it will probably go on general release at some point. And maybe also to mention the Big Picture Rewilding Conference will be held in Perth on the 14th of September.
Right.
There may well be a screening of Why Not Scotland there. I'm not sure yet, but it's anybody who's interested at all in land use, land management, rewilding, ecological restoration, please come along to the Big Picture Conference in September.
That sounds fantastic. I get the sense that things are changing. I get the sense that things are moving. Maybe not as quick as you or I would probably like it.
Yeah.
But we are going. And I think, let's hope we live in 100 years' time or even 50 years' time, we're in a very different Scotland from the Scotland that we're in now. And maybe we'll get there. What I'll do is, thanks very much for that, Alan. I'll put links to the to Scotland, the big picture, and the new film on my on this website page, and let's hope as many people as possible can go along and see it. Okay, thanks. Thanks very much for talking to me, Alan.
Thank you. Nice to speak to you.